January 16th, 2014. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the dreary Chicago suburbs. I really appreciate you joining me today on RBN. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. RBN is continuing its pledge drive. Just donate $100 and receive an RBN t-shirt and an RBN mug or 25 copper Republic of Texas rounds. To make a donation, please call 800-724-2719. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit Spingola.com, where you will see the names of all the guests that I've had on the program, as well as links to their websites. Just visit the website and click on the radio schedule button. Please also visit SpingolaSpeaks.info or SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com, a site that one of our wonderful listeners created. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@Spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to spingola.chatingo.com. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. She is the author of Murder by Medicine is No Accident, The Lethal Dose, Why Your Doctor is Prescribing It. She is also the co-author of Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? Her websites are, well, it's actually the same one, VitalityCapsules.com or DrJenniferDaniels.com. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you. You're always just so full of wonderful information for us, and you just tell it like it is, and we appreciate your candor and your honesty and your integrity. It's wonderful to talk to a blacklisted doctor who was blacklisted for the character that you have, that you are. And that's great. It's not great that you were blacklisted. It's great that you had the integrity to do what was right.
Well, actually, I'm kind of glad I was blacklisted. I mean, I never would have left the country. I never would have met my wonderful husband. I wouldn't be living in wonderful Panama. So I'm kind of okay with it.
Oh, that's great. I guess you've made lemonade out of lemons or something like that.
Something like that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, that's wonderful. Well, you're going to talk about drug trials today, and which is a very interesting topic. I've been reading a bit about those trials, and oh my goodness, what the pharmaceutical companies do is just outrageous and deadly.
Yeah, it's really shocking, and the thing is, as a doctor, being so indoctrinated, and when you say brainwashed, you throw that term around lightly, but we doctors really are. I mean, to be subjected to 90 to 120 waking hours every week and to have those hours crammed full of propaganda at such a fast rate that we don't even have time to reflect or question it, and then to be evaluated on how deeply we believe that propaganda. And this goes on for a period of anywhere from 5 to 12 years, depending on your specialty. And at the end of the process, you have an individual almost incapable of critical thinking.
Indeed, and it certainly, that is the way that that brainwashing takes place, is they prevent, they actually put you in a situation where you're not able to clearly think. And you're in a traumatized situation. I think it's probably similar to the traumatized situation that the American public found themselves in on 9/11, and that was a perfect environment to tell the people what they wanted the people to know or think about what had happened that day. And I compare it to that.
Yeah, and in medical school, it's kind of like that happens at least twice a week. You have a good 9/11 every week.
Indeed.
And by the end of the four-year process, you feel your only hope is to believe everything you've been told and to let the scientists who are doing all the research find the answers so you can hurry up and apply them while there's still time.
Oh, goodness. And of course, the scientists aren't really working on creating drugs that are beneficial for the patients. They're working really hard. All the money that we think is going to research is actually going to pay off doctors and to pay off people to endorse their products, to buy actors, to act on TV that yeah. swear by all these products. Oh, goodness.
Wow. These actors, they really do earn their money. They put on a pretty good show.
They do. Yeah. They really do. And because they are popular figures in the media and in the entertainment world, people really buy into what they say. I don't know why. Why would anybody believe an actor? They're acting.
Yeah, lying is their job.
Right.
It's my job to lie and pretend to get you to believe I'm someone that you know I can't possibly be. That's what I do. I lie. Here, let
exactly.
me tell you more lies.
Exactly. Well, you've been involved in some trials, you've tried to be involved in some trials, in some scientific investigation, and apparently they didn't really like what you produced because you were really serious about this, and they weren't really wanting you to produce anything that you produced, correct?
Yeah. What I didn't understand was that getting at the truth is not the reason for a drug trial. And I didn't understand was investigating and discovering the unknown is not the purpose of research. So the word is research as in search again, and you keep searching until you get the right answer. That's research.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you say, I did this study and this is what I saw, it is okay for someone to say to you, let's change that. You didn't really see that. And so I don't know if your listeners heard this story, but I guess I'll tell it again just to kind of bring it up to speed. But when I was in medical school, you know, everyone in medical school, you know, goes to classes, examines people, learns about drugs. But I decided, okay, I'll take it another step further. I'm going to learn about research. I'm going to take a course researching a particular something or other, and I'm just going to do the research. Whatever the chief investigator wants, I'll research it. And so I spent a whole summer, I worked at least 6 days a week, 10 hours a day at least, from sunup to sundown, you know, gathering data points, my eyes glued to the microscope, studying these sliced up liver sections. And so at the end of the summer, I presented my findings. And the professor said, I don't like these results. I said, well, do you think that I made a mistake? They were inaccurate? No. I just want you to change them. I said, well, what would you like me to change them to? He said, well, I don't care. Just change them. I don't want those results. Just change it to something else.
Amazing.
And so I did not realize was he was actually doing me a favor. He was trying to prepare me for the real world of research, that you get results, whatever they are, and then you change them. And then when you change them, then you write a paper based on your changed results. But I saw it the way you just perceived it, as an ethical issue. And so I said, well, I will not be compromised. I said, well, Professor, I'm not going to change the data. He said, well, if you don't change this data, I'm not giving you credit for this medical school course. I said, oh, that's absurd. And so I marched right into the dean of students' office, and I said, look, we got a problem here, and I know you can help me. This professor's asked me to falsify data. I can tell you, and he'll probably tell you too, that I faithfully worked throughout the whole course. I showed up every single day. I worked long, hard hours. I did everything, and blah, blah, blah. I've even written the abstract for him. And he won't give me credit unless I lie.
Wow. All righty, we are going to take a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back with our guest today, Dr. Jennifer Daniels. Today is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. She is the author of Murder by Medicine is No Accident, The Lethal Dose, Why Your Doctor is Prescribing It. It is available at Amazon. Her website is vitalitycapsules.com. www.dean.com. And, yes, so anyway, you talked to the dean, and it didn't work out real well.
Yeah, the dean, I told the dean what happened. The dean said, "Oh, Jennifer, surely you must have misunderstood the good doctor." I said, "Well, you go talk to him yourself and see what you figure out." So he went to the good doctor and talked to the good doctor, and the good doctor told him, of all things, the truth. So the dean met with me again and says, "Well, Jennifer, I did talk to the good doctor, and yes, what you did say was accurate, but I've negotiated a good deal for you. If you will do an additional 3 months of research for the good doctor, he will give you credit for the first 3 months, even though you refused to falsify the information." And I know you about medical school. Medical school time is very, very tight. Losing 3 months can, like, keep you from graduating. And so for me to gamble that I might get credit for the second 3 months, because all he's promising me is credit for the first 3 months, not credit for the second 3 months. So he said, as to falsifying data, you know, he is the doctor in charge of his course, and he can set the course requirements as he wishes, and that's one of his criteria. I said, "Oh, I see." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I really appreciate you talking to the good doctor, but I'm going to pass on this deal." And I basically continued on in medical school. It was the beginning of my first year, my second year of medical school, because it was during the summer of my first year that this happened. So I continued with my courses in my second year, and I took extra courses over Christmas holiday, which is the full month off that you get, and courses on weekends and other holidays to add the credits to make up the 3 months. And I also promptly went over to business school to register. I need a break. I need a breath of fresh air.
Right. And why did you do that? Just so that you would have that background for your own business?
Well, I planned to go back to the ghetto where I grew up to practice medicine. And so I knew that just because I was in the ghetto didn't mean I wouldn't have to pay bills. So how was I going to collect money and run my medical practice in a sound manner so that I could get the bills paid and continue to operate there? So that was the background I was looking for medical, from business school.
Okay. All righty. And you didn't, in as much as you provided a lot of natural healing protocols for your patients, that didn't have anything to do with the pharmaceutical industry, you probably didn't get some of the benefits that the pharmaceutical industry gives out to doctors. Is that correct?
Well, starting out, I got all of them. I mean, oh, my God, it was like Christmas every week.
Really? Tell us a little bit about
that. Oh, my gosh. I mean, a few $1,000 just for opening up. I had this big, huge reception for my office on the opening day. It was all catered by the drug reps. And each drug rep had their own personal station in the office where they gave little tours of their part of the office I assigned them to give tours of. They cleaned up the whole office after the reception for the community. Oh, my gosh. You just can't believe the support. And then I was having babies at that time, and I kept up with my children in terms of what their hobbies were and gave them gifts and everything. This was before I, you know, slurred everything out. I said, "Oh, my God, these drug reps are such helpful people." But
oh,
as
goodness.
Time went on, and I realized that, first of all, the drug reps are pesky. If you're not careful, you'll see more drug reps in a day than you see patients. And drug reps, for all of their helpfulness and all of their gifts, they don't give you nearly as much money as the patients do. So, but they do wheedle their way in, and they tell you that they're giving you all these gifts and that, you should talk to them, listen to them. This is time you could be spending earning real serious cash.
And helping patients.
We'll dispense with that for a minute, because doctors are under such incredible financial pressure that the first thing is to see the patient and get paid, and then you can worry about, okay, let's help the patient. But here I am, it's a new practice just opened up, and these drug reps are really monopolizing my time. And they're telling me, of course, how much I need them and their gifts. And meanwhile, I was noticing that their whiz-bang wonder drugs just were not helping my patients. I mean, like, to say that the results were underwhelming would be an understatement. It was just out-and-out carnage. But I'll never forget one guy. He had a new antibiotic, and he wanted me to try this antibiotic. And I said, well, you know, I don't know. Well, just try it on like three people. And he gave me this chess set. I don't play chess, my brother does. It was a marble chess set with chiseled glass pieces.
Wow.
And ebony and clear crystal. And so I gave that set to my brother for Christmas, and he was just totally impressed. But at any rate, so I tried it out on one person who had bronchitis, which is what the antibiotic was supposed to be helpful for. And the person not only did not get better, but I got a phone call at 2 a.m. that night from this person telling me they felt like they were going to die. Well, thank goodness, I was a little quick on my feet, and I said, don't take another one of those antibiotics. Drink a glass of water and give me a call in the morning and we know how things are going.
Are you at liberty to tell us which antibiotic that was?
You know, I don't even remember, but it was a it was a fluoxetine.
Okay.
So it was in the same class as Cipro, so it was in that class.
Okay.
But the next day she says, wow, I feel so much better. Can I restart that drug? I said, absolutely not.
Ah.
And so I tried the drug on a second patient. The exact same thing happened. A 2 a.m. call. Oh, I think I'm going to die. I said, wait a minute. First of all, the drug wakes me up. That's the end of that. I'm not prescribing that drug anymore. But most doctors wouldn't even realize it was the drug that woke the patient up. Second of all, most doctors don't take their own call. So another doctor would have been waking up with that phone call, would not have realized it was because a new drug was started, and might have continued the drug, and the patient died. And in fact, the drug is, I believe it was Levaquin was the drug.
Oh.
It was Levaquin. And that drug has since been the cause of many deaths, matter of fact.
I had an anaphylactic shock. I went into anaphylaxis over that drug.
There you go. And you were lucky. Your life was saved.
I was actually in the hospital. My medical records at that hospital said that I was allergic to it, and the nurses gave it to me anyway in an IV, and within just a short period of time, I'm just really, really in dire straits.
Not doing well, right. So a lot of, so this got me thinking, how could it be that this drug, so much research was done, it was approved by the FDA, and I gave it to only two patients, and two out of two patients had devastating reactions. I think that's devastating. When a patient calls me and says, I think I'm dying, and they wake me up at 2 a.m., I call that devastating.
Yes.
So I deduce that, you know, the research must be fraudulent. It's got to be fraudulent.
Indeed.
So I knew that the drug trials had to be getting experiencing serious harm in the drug trial. But this was not reflected in the FDA approval. No, it wasn't approved with reservations. This was not reflected in the package insert. And so I knew the drug trials had to be harming and even killing people. The next thing I figured out from medical school and reflection is that these drugs had to be designed to harm. How do I know they're designed to harm? Because the protocols, any protocol that you get, reads like this. Patient complains of A. Give drug B. Drug B doesn't work, give drug C. Drug C doesn't work, give drug D. And it goes on and on like that, and finally says admit to hospital. Wait a minute, time out. This patient showed up walking, talking, and healthy, and now I'm giving him a series of drugs and then admitting him to the hospital?
Yikes.
Oh.
Wow. All righty. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Deanna, our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. She is the author of Murder by Medicine, Is No Accident, The Lethal Dose, Why Your Doctor is Prescribing It. Her website is vitalitycapsules.com. A few months back, based on your programs and based on my increased confidence in what I was learning, I threw out every single commercial product in my bathroom, all the prescriptions, and I'm one of those that keeps everything. I threw it all out. I don't have any aspirin. I don't have any Tylenol. I don't have any of that kind of stuff. I have things like turpentine. I have things that are really helpful. And that's what I have in my medicine cabinet.
And it makes a difference, and it really works. And it works even quicker than the other stuff does.
It does. It does. And it was, I was really, but it takes a while to get over the brainwashing, because we are all consumers, and we're not patients, we're consumers, and we all believe that stuff until we learn. But it takes a while for it to sink in. It takes a while to get past that indoctrination.
Yeah, it takes a lot of disappointment. You really have to be disappointed quite a bit, over and over and over and over again. And finally you say, wait a minute, if I'm believing this, and it's not giving the results it's supposed to be getting, maybe I have a false belief. Let me reexamine something.
Sure, sure. And as you say, it does take time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people will hear me talk and say, oh, easy for you, Dr. Dennis. But, you know, it took me 30 years. That's a long time to be hoodwinked.
Sure.
You know, I'm just helping other people maybe come up to speed a little quicker. But we were taught even in medical school that drugs are designed to be harmful. Drugs are dangerous. Drugs can kill people very easily. And that's why they have to be prescription. That's why the wisdom of the doctor is needed in order to prescribe a dangerous substance in a safe, effective, even beneficial manner. So we're really built up to believe that with the knowledge we had, it would allow us to administer poison, yet cause that poison to heal.
It just doesn't make sense. And I have a friend. I'm sorry to mean to interrupt. I have a friend whose relatives recently got a flu shot, and she was talking to them on the phone, and the lady said, oh, I am so sick. Her husband and her had just gotten their flu shots, and she said, oh, we are just so sick. And you know, this happened last year. We got so sick last year. And these are educated people. Mm-hmm. Educated people, and they don't see the cause and effect.
Correct.
It's amazing to me.
It's trained blindness, and I think the more education a person has, the worse it is.
Ah.
Yeah. I notice that in my practice. You give me a high school dropout any day, and cure that person in 10 minutes, whatever ails them. Tell them what they need to do natural, they'll do it, boom, they're better. Take someone with a PhD, oh my God. Oh boy, it's going to be a while. Going to be a while.
Yeah,
I can tell you a bunch of PhD stories, but I won't. And so the other thing I realized, though, is that a harmless substance absolutely cannot be approved as a drug. It's not possible. So in order to be approved as a drug, a substance must be harmful. And the way that I deduced this was when I realized that if you accept a government, a doctor prescription, so a government, FDA approved substance, and you put that in your body, you'll require, on average, 3 times as much in medical care. What does that mean? It means if you ingest a $200 prescription, you're going to need $600 in medical care to address the side effects of that prescription. So I realized that if a drug was harmless, the FDA would not even be submitted to for approval, and it wouldn't be. It couldn't happen. So if the FDA approved it, it's got to be dangerous. And so I was wondering about this, and I was thinking to myself, well, there should be some evidence then that drug trials themselves are especially deadly and especially dangerous. And there's this lady called Bambi who writes for the Discovery Channel, of all things, how appropriate. And she concludes, stay away from phase 1 trials. And that's actually not safe to participate in drug trials. Drug companies now do their trials overseas. Why? Because overseas governments, many of them, will allow the drug companies to administer these drugs to large numbers of people, And if somebody dies, you just attribute the death to something else. And then you only measure the data points of the people who, A, live, or, B, improve. And that's why a lot of these drug results don't really make any sense. For example, if you look at the research surrounding menopause and menopause drugs, you're going to find every study is going to have different risk factors. So what you do is you have, keep the numbers simple, 1,000 women, give the drug to half the women and don't give it to the other half. Okay. Other half you give it to, some of them appear to improve. You count those parts, you don't count the other ones. And so those who appear to improve, you figure out what are their characteristics. Okay, they tend to be married. All right, they tend to be over 100 pounds. Okay, they tend to be, you figure out all these characteristics that seem to be associated with these women who are improved by your drug. And then you say your drug works best in women with those features and those characteristics. And you behave as if those characteristics produce a better drug outcome. When really, it's that those characteristics are just random associations. And so one study will say that women over 100 pounds do better. Another study will say women under 100 pounds will do better. One study will say women with larger breasts do better. Another study will say women with smaller breasts do better. And on and on and on. So it's very confusing, and doctors absolutely have no basis for sorting it out. But what I wanted to say is that they count on these governments to allow them to give these drugs to large populations, and then they can just take the data they get, and whoever dies, you don't count them, and then whoever lives, you just segregate, decide which data points you want to count. And so what happened was the drug companies wanted to do this in India. And India said, you know what, we're not going to say you can't do drug trials. Of course you can do drug trials. But you must accept responsibility for every health affliction a person has while they're participating in your drug trial. So if you have 1,000 people in your drug trial, whether they're taking your drug or not, you're responsible for all their medical expenses during that drug trial. And should they die during the course of the drug trial, and I think 30 days after or something like that, then you have to pay their family a certain amount of money. Well, the drug company said, absolutely not. Well, get this. If what you're given is so good, if it really works, and if it's so safe, why not? Because all you're going to do is get people better, and then they're not going to need any health care anyway. So why not? So obviously the reason is because this type of responsibility would not only make the drug trials more expensive, but it would not allow them to get the data they need to get FDA approval, because then the death would be counted as that company's responsibility, and they would have a paper trail. And so the doctors then, I mean, not the doctors, but the drug companies go to different countries to do their drug trial.
Indeed. There was one study that was done for insulin, the new human insulin, where they only used 17 people. And yet that drug was approved in 2 years without any study at all. And the reason that they did this, they used to use animal insulin, which was hardly any cost at all. And, of course, once people start using insulin, it's a lifetime kind of a situation. And so the drug companies are more interested in money, and they can make more money with a patented drug than they can with something like animal insulin. And so they got it passed in 2 years using only 17 people, but it's worth millions in an ongoing basis because of all the people who are diabetic.
Exactly. And then the human insulin is not made from human anything. There's nothing human about it. It's made from animal feces.
Oh, yikes.
And so people are led to believe, by the name, Humulin, that it's made from humans. Oh, wow, this is great. No. It's made from E. coli, which is the main ingredient in human and animal feces. So it's really very misleading. It's difficult to understand this stuff unless you say, what is the meaning of each one of these words? And you have to look up each word, because the English meaning, conversational meaning that you understand it to be, is not what it is at all. And so the other thing that happened is when I was in medical school, healthcare costs were rising, and the health insurance companies were trying to make money.
Sure.
And so they had some intervention that made things even more dangerous.
All righty. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back with our guest today, Dr. Jennifer Daniels. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. Her website is vitalitycapsules.com, and she is the author of Murder by Medicine is No Accident, The Lethal Dose, Why Your Doctor is Prescribing It. How's that book doing?
I think it's doing pretty good. I just figured out how to get my back in and take a look at how it's selling. So
great.
So
I never have to
figure
that out. Good.
Yeah, we've got to check on that. But the insurance companies noticed that the cost of hospitals was increasing. And so what they did, they intervened and started a policy whereby every hospital admission had to be justified on the basis that the therapy given in the hospital was too dangerous for the patient to receive the same therapy at home. In other words, the therapy given had to be dangerous. Doctors would start an IV just to make sure they and the hospital got paid. And as you know, IVs, breaking the skin, can cause a way for deadly infections to enter the body and, of course, ultimately kill the patient. And so we had this understanding then, kind of subliminal or whatever, that what we were using was deadly, even though the drug reps were telling us it was safe. And so let's take a look at the FDA process, what goes on with these deadly studies. First of all, there's phase zero. But you didn't know there was phase zero. I didn't know there was a phase zero. Phase zero is they try it out on animals. If the animals drop dead, well, stop right there. And so it's starting the animal studies to see if the drug is absorbed and if it's deadly. So let's say it's safe for animals. Then in phase one, you screen for safety for humans. So you take a bunch of human beings, and you just give them the drug and see if anybody drops dead or what side effects they have. If the side effects are agreeable, you don't have any deaths, I'm just saying supposedly, then you proceed to phase two. And phase two is where you establish the drug is actually effective for something. Usually you test it against a placebo. And the placebo is chosen by the drug company. In other words, the placebo is not a sugar pill. It's not a little bit of talc powder. It's whatever the drug company wants to use. And many drug companies have chosen Benadryl as a placebo.
Some people do better on the placebo than they do on the drug.
Exactly. Well, they keep picking a different placebo until they find one that seems to not do as well as the drug. And then phase three, final confirmation, you have to repeat studies to show that it's safe and effective. And that at that point, after phase three, is where FDA steps in, looks at all the data, and approves it or doesn't approve it. This is classically the way it's supposed to take place. However, in 1990, they decided that drug approval process was just too long and that life-saving drugs, an oxymoron, life-saving drugs were not getting to the public fast enough. And so what they wanted to do was approve drugs before phase three was complete. In other words, approved drugs for use in patients before final confirmation of safety and effectiveness was achieved. In other words, the drug could have no evidence of effective efficacy or safety yet be approved. Then you have phase four. Phase four is where you have sentry studies during trials. That means during sales. That means you're selling the drug, it's been approved. And if someone drops dead, they call the FDA and report an adverse reaction or whatever. It's kind of like a spotty event where you just kind of keep track of what's happening to see if something's, amiss.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens, what does the company do when a drug fails to pass any of these trials? Let's just say the drug is not safe, not effective. You put all this money into developing it, and it can't seem to pass any of these screens, even though you've designed the studies yourself, and it's just not doing well. Well, they have something called rescue countries. One big factor in the shift of clinical trials to foreign countries is a loophole in FDA regulation. So if a study in the United States suggest that a drug has no benefit, then drug trials from abroad can be used in their stead to secure FDA approval. This is in the law. So there's even a term for countries that have shown themselves to be especially amenable when drug companies need positive data fast. And they're called rescue countries. And rescue countries came to the aid of one famous antibiotic called Ketek. And this is the first of a new generation of wildly heralded antibiotics to treat respiratory tract infections. It was developed in the 90s, and of course, it was approved on April Fool's Day, of course, as luck would have it.
Oh, how appropriate.
And it was certified as safe and effective. And the decision was based heavily on results of studies in Hungary, Morocco, Tunisia, and Turkey. And the approvals came less than 1 month after a researcher in the United States was sentenced to 57 months in prison for falsifying her own Ketek data. So this is what's going on with these drug trials. So you have a drug trial. You do it overseas. You let them know what results you want. Okay, don't count any dead bodies. Don't count severe side effects. This is our definition of improvement. You know, if a seizure patient has 9 seizures a week instead of 10 seizures a week, we call that improved. And so then you put out a study that says 90% of patients improved after taking XYZ drug. This is the kind of research that's going on, and that's the basis of approving drugs. And so in this particular case, this doctor enrolled more than 400 volunteers, about 1% of the town's total adult population, including her entire office staff, in these medical trials. And she collected $400 for each from the drug company. And it later came to light that the data from at least 91% of her patients was falsified. So 91% of the patients she said was enrolled in the trial, she actually fabricated the data, just built numbers into the spots.
Oh, goodness. That is terrible. And it just goes to show that the pharmaceutical companies are more interested in profits. They don't care a thing about the patients. They don't exist to take care of patients. They exist to accrue profits. And I think that most people aren't aware of this because they wouldn't think of doing that themselves. I think it takes kind of a psychopathic mentality to come up with stuff like that.
Well, no, I don't think so. I think it takes a certain combination of financial pressures, economic pressures. We did this little exercise in business school. And first the teacher said, the instructor said, okay, how many of you are familiar with pharmaceutical drugs? Oh, yeah, we all are. How many of you think it's real important for them to be safe? Oh, yes. Would you want to take a dangerous drug? Oh, no. Oh, okay, just checking. Okay, we had this exercise. The exercise was this. You are the executive director in a pharmaceutical company. And one person was the executive director, one was the marketing director, whatever. And you've got this drug, you spent all this money on the drug, the FDA is poised to approve it, and you are aware there's been 10 deaths, probably more, but 10 that you're aware of. And you know once this drug's approved, it will not offer any benefit over what was already on the market, and likely there will be several more deaths a year because the drug was approved. And what do you do? And it was shocking that I think 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10 of the groups decided to push forward, conceal the data, and get the FDA approval.
Wow.
And so it takes a lot less pressure than you would think to get an otherwise sensible human being to go for this stuff. I mean, for me, in medical school, most students would have crumbled just at the thought of losing the professor's approval because they're trying to get a good grade, right?
And so sure, which goes back to your example, your experience.
Right, so first threat was low grade. I didn't pass that screen. I said, no, I'm not falsifying anything. Then, okay, the next threat was no credit for the course. I didn't pass that screen. I said, well, what do you mean? I'm just not going to falsify it. You're not going to give me credit? No problem. I'll just have to get credit for and graduate another way. And so most people are not willing to suffer disapproval, are not willing to suffer economic loss or personal inconvenience. And just with that minimal pressure, you can get people to act in this manner as long as they believe that, one, they're acting as part of an organization, and two, that what they're going to be found guilty of is not going to be murder, but something much more remote, minimal, and, you know, easily avoided.
Amazing. All righty, we are going to our top of the hour break. We will be back at 6 minutes after the hour with our guest, Dr. Jennifer Daniels.
Tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. She is the author of Murder by Medicine is No Accident, The Lethal Dose, Why Your Doctor is Prescribing It. She is also the co-author of Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? Her website is vitalitycapsules.com. And she does have a program here on RBN on Sunday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And that program is entitled Healing with Dr. Jennifer Daniels. So that's really great. I'm glad you're on RBN.
Yeah, it's a great audience. I even have a chat room, and when I have technical difficulties, I pitch in and make suggestions that actually help, so it's really nice.
They are good.
They really are. Last week we talked about what's a woman worth. We talked about how women can heal the home and really be an incredible force in the home that is beneficial to the health of everyone in the house. And exactly. So this Sunday we're going to get more secret herbal healing formulas from, of course, Dr. Daniels' kitchen and Dr. Daniels' experience as well.
Yes. Now, somebody in my chat room asked about kerosene as a medicine. And, of course, I know that the Rockefellers sold kerosene in China for a couple of decades. And then and I think that that's the way they kind of snuck in the back door to get allopathic medicine into China as well.
Yeah, well, I think that there's not a lot of backdoor to it. It's just, you know, paying a lot of bribes. And
sure.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that going on, just totally, really commandeering the apparatus of the government. Even in the United States, I just see absolutely no evidence for any groundswell demand for what the drug companies are doing.
Boy, is that
true. It's definitely a top-down thing.
Sure, sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, now, goodness. In New Delhi, they had an issue in terms of the research, where 49 babies died at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences while taking part in clinical trials over a 30-month period. So they were given a variety of new drugs to treat everything from high blood pressure to chronic focal encephalitis, a brain inflammation that causes seizures and other neurological problems. And the blood pressure drugs had never before been given to anyone under 18. And the editor of the Indian Medical Journal said it was obvious the trials were intended to extend patent life in the Western countries with no consequences or benefit for India, using children as guinea pigs. So what they did was by giving the drugs to this large population of human beings, it allowed them to count only the ones who lived and to say the drug was actually safe. And these are the kinds of deadly trials that we are talking about. And closer to home, in the mid-90s, Galaxo conducted clinical trials on the antidepressant Paxil, in the United States, in Europe, and in South America. And if you're not familiar, Paxil is a member of a drug called SSRI, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Mm-hmm. And so it includes things like Zoloft and Prozac. But the clinical trials show that the drug has no beneficial effect on adolescents. Some of the trials even indicate, as you mentioned, that the placebo was more effective than the drug itself.
Right.
But Glaxo neglected to share this information with consumers, or the FDA for that matter. And then annual sales of this drug reached $5 billion in 2003. And in a memo, an internal document obtained by the Canadian Medical Association Journal, the company emphasized how important it was to effectively manage the dissemination of these data and information. So there's a conscious effort on the part of drug companies to conceal the deadly nature of these drugs. And as a doctor prescribing these drugs, I was just absolutely floored, shocked at how overwhelmingly harmful these safe and effective drugs appeared to be, and also how ineffective they were. So let's go over the phase trials again. So phase zeros may do the animals, see if it's safe for animals. And then after that, phase one is done in humans. And these usually involve only a small number of people to determine if a drug or treatment is safe and to determine the best dose of the drug and how it should be given, whether orally or intravenously. And so this phase one clinical trial is a very dangerous phase to be involved in as a subject, because while the drug may be safe for animals, there's no evidence or knowledge that it's safe in humans. So there may or may not be deaths at this stage, phase one. So you would expect at phase one of two things would happen. Either there's no death, a thoroughly safe drug, or two, there are deaths, but you know the dose the deaths occur at, and you recommend a dose that's less than that when you prescribe it later on to the public. That's what you would think. But then there's, so let's say it is safe, you find a safe level, then you go to control clinical trials and evaluate the drug's effectiveness for a particular indication, for example, hypertension or depression or whatever the disease is under study, and to determine common short-term side effects and risks associated with the drug. Now, the problem with this process is that increasingly the FDA is allowing drug companies to skip phases. So phase four, where you give the drug to anybody and everyone the doctor prescribes it to, make it available to the public, is replacing phase three, where you determine that it's safe and effective, and replacing phase two, where you determine that it's effective, and replacing phase one, where it's effective. So drugs are going from laboratory to medicine cabinet without these intermediate phases. And that's what's making drugs increasingly more dangerous and increasingly more deadly. And it's so out of hand that lawyers have actually identified eight drugs that doctors will not take.
Oh, what are those drugs?
I don't think I cut and pasted that. I didn't do that. But the question is, why would a doctor refuse to take a drug?
Yes, indeed.
Two reasons I can think of. One, he's seen that it harmed many patients, and he doesn't want to experience that harm. Or two, he participated in a clinical trial for a drug and saw the data before it was sanitized. And this happened to me. I did a drug trial. I paid $50 for each of, in this case, four office visits for each subject. And, of course, the patient paid nothing. But my data showed, from my patients that I entered into a trial, that the drug was absolutely not effective. And the cholesterol for the patients actually went up during the trial. Of course, my data points did not carry as much weight, and Tricor was approved as a cholesterol-lowering drug. It's still being sold today.
Right. And that's,
I talked
of course,
to other doctors.
Didn't they lower the standards for what cholesterol should be just so they could get a lot of people on a cholesterol-lowering drug?
Absolutely, they did, to increase the pool. But what happened was, how could this drug be approved when all the data I gathered for this study showed that it was ineffective? So I talked to my other colleagues who I knew participated in the study, and I said, I told them just what I told you. I said, you know, none of my patients got better with that drug. The cholesterol didn't go down. And do you know what they told me? I said, Dr. Daniels, we knew what numbers to write in those boxes for the study results. So my colleagues were writing in numbers showing the drug was effective when it wasn't. And this is the basis of, you know, drug approval.
Right. Oh, goodness. And of course, doctors are often influenced or paid to take a drug that has not been approved yet and use it with their patients. And then their patients do better on it, then they can be a voice, a persuasive kind of a tactic to get approval. Correct?
Correct. And that also pressures the doctor to lie.
Indeed. Alrighty, we are going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. She does have a program on RBN on Sunday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. called Healing with Dr. Jennifer Daniels. Her website is vitalitycapsules.com. She is the author of Murder by Medicine is No Accident, The Lethal Dose, Why Your Doctor is Prescribing It. All righty, we were talking about... Well, we were talking about a lot of things, but
we're talking about Tricor, that cholesterol medicine.
Cholesterol.
Yeah, so the medicine was totally ineffective. At the end of the 90 days, I just took my patients off the medicine, the ones that had agreed to be in a study. And I was absolutely shocked when a patient said to me, well, Dr. Jeff, can I continue the medicine?
Nice.
I said, what for? It doesn't work. And they said, oh, I thought I was supposed to take it the rest of my life. They pre-programmed the patients to expect and accept taking a medicine the rest of your life, whether it works or not. I just thought my patients were more sensible than that. But they'd just been so so programmed. And so what happens, though, is imagine they're paying me $50 for each office visit. 4 visits is $200. And then they're paying for the drug. And so that's $200 per patient per 90 days in the trial. And you can compare that to either paying nothing or paying $1 a day for a study participant. So overseas, they can pay the so-called patient or study person $1 for each time they come in to see the doctor or to get measured. And so literally, they have something called advanced scouts for the pharmaceutical industry, and they visit scores of cities and towns all over the globe, looking for people willing to undergo clinical trials for new drugs.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's like, pick me, I want to be a guinea pig. Yeah, I'll take your $100, pick me. That is the stupidest thing.
But they're not even offering $100 outside the U.S. They're offering like $1.
Oh, I can't believe
They use this bogus data to help persuade the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. to approve the drug. Now, in defense of these people all around the world, many of them are lied to. Many of the mothers are told that their kids are receiving therapy for a condition, not that their kids are receiving experimental drugs that have no proven value. So they often don't even know that they're in a clinical trial.
And, of course, the earlier that they can get a person on a drug, the better and more money that they're going to make. And so they are really wanting to get babies, infants, on a drug almost as soon as they're born and to have them be consumers for the rest of their lives.
Yep. So in plain English, then, drug companies shop for cities around the world where they can convince poor people to take dangerous drugs. And those who die are buried and never counted as part of the trial. And those who show no benefit are also not counted. So the data is submitted to the FDA for approval to be used on you and your loved ones. And this is going on real time today. And these reports, it's an endless stream. And there are companies that get paid money for hosting or creating a clinical trial and getting the needed results.
Right.
And there's been no change in policies in the FDA to either refuse data collected on foreigners or to inspect foreign drug trials.
And the FDA does no testing at all.
No. So the data is made available to the public only on a purely voluntary basis, and the accuracy of the data is totally unknown.
Goodness. And in order to be approved by the FDA, I knew a lady that worked for the FDA, and she said, oh, well, if you want approval, you have to pay a fee, like a dairy company could pay a fee to get approved or whatever. And so it's just a big scam. And yet a lot of people think that the FDA does all this testing to protect the American public. That is just not the truth at all.
Well, I think the other thing to look at in terms of this being so, being very transparent, upfront, plain about this is, you know, we're talking about billions of dollars here. And when you're talking about billions of dollars, it's tough to entrust a third party with your personal health when billions of dollars are at stake. And so Germany has come across a few things. So what Germany says is, all right, you guys, you do what you do, but we're going to withdraw approval of drugs that were developed using these research methods. So any drug trial that has unconsenting subjects, concealed side effects, and bribes for results, they're just not going to approve it. And that seems to be really the only level at which anything can possibly work. I mean, if you realize these people are not asking the FDA for approval, they're really demanding it, and they're doing bribes, and when bribes don't work, then you have violence. And I'm not saying they do or don't resort to that, but I'm just saying you have something comparable to really hardcore, high-end, mafia-type pressure techniques here. And so the American citizen needs to realize that the whole process, just the creation of the FDA in and of itself, creates a mechanism ripe for undue influence and pressure. It's like when I was in Syracuse, we little community people were organizing to protest the unfair behavior of the bank. And we just were telling the Federal Reserve, these two banks should not be allowed to merge unless the bank with the worst lending practices improved what it was doing. And that's a pretty low-level request. We weren't requesting free loans or money or anything. Yet, the bank invested in a detective to fully investigate every single member on the community committee, to harass every single member at their job, to harass the spouse of every single member with loss of their job, if the community members did not all vote to approve any proposal the bank put ahead of them. And that is a lot of firepower when you think about it. And many people would back down. In fact, they did. In my case, I wasn't married, so didn't have a spouse to influence. And I was self-employed. So when they called to influence my employer, my receptionist, who I paid, answered the phone. And so when she would answer the phone, hello, Dr. Daniel's office. Would you like to talk to Dr. Daniel? No. And they'd leave a message for me to call them because there's anything I could do for them. And so if the public understood that this is the kind of power being brought to bear, then they would understand that there is no agency that can stand between them and this kind of overwhelming force and resources. And therefore, you just simply take your trust out of the FDA and you put it someplace else. That's it. Very simple. This is not a problem that can be solved through government action. It just can't be. Because, again, the amount of power being brought to bear here is such that it can and has influenced the whole governing apparatus so as to make it unable to defend the interests of or the health of the individual citizen. And when people realize this, I mean, it's like using a mop on the floor to try and get your teeth clean. It's just not an appropriate strategy.
Sure.
And if you're trying to heal, if that's what you're after, then an FDA-approved substance is not a reasonable strategy.
Right. I mean, just the whole creation of the FDA back in, 1906, 1907, was basically just for the benefit of the corporations, and it was the, it was after the, what was the name of the book, that, The Jungle, by Sinclair. Lewis Sinclair. No, it wasn't Lewis Sinclair. Who wrote that? The Jungle. Anyway, it was quite an emotionally packed book, and it really got the public to want some sort of agency to oversee the food. Okay, we're going to be right back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsor. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Daniel. She is the author of Murder by Medicine is No Accident, The Lethal Dose, Why Your Doctor is Prescribing It. She's co-author of Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? Her website is vitalitycapsules.com. And I thought of the author as Upton Sinclair. He wrote The Jungle. And, yeah, it just made everybody in the country, well, a lot of people in the country were just pleading for more regulation. And so they used that to impose the FDA on the American public.
Exactly, and we see where it's gotten us.
Yes, yes indeed. Well, should we take some phone calls? I'm sure people are in the audience or probably have some questions, particularly about, drug trials and, oh, gosh, some of the things that I've read just in the last week about drug trials. Before, I thought, well, I'm never going to take another prescription drug because, honestly, I have been sick more from prescription drugs and from medical intervention than if I hadn't had any intervention. That's what's made me sick. Anything that I've ever had, if I trace it back, I can think of why it happened.
So you can trace it back to medical intervention?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely. Or from a drug. And because you don't expect drugs to make you sick, but as in the examples that you gave of the two people calling you in the middle of the night and saying, gosh, I'm really sick. Well, I mean, that's,
ready to attribute their sickness to their primary illness.
Right.
But I knew better. Because I had the experience of people coming in with a cough or a cold. You don't have a cold at 10 a.m., and then at 2 a.m. you feel like you're going to die.
Right. Right.
You stop the antibiotic, and boom, the person, they get better. Their feeling of impending doom goes away.
Right. And speaking of antibiotics, you do have on your website, and I think people should sign up on your website to get your email and to get your free booklet on what to use instead of antibiotics. And you have several things that are very effective without any side effects. Excuse me.
That's correct. That's a special gift for your audience. And antibiotics as a class of drugs are especially dangerous. They're responsible in 2012 for 63,000 deaths in the United States alone. That's a lot of deaths. And these deaths are covered up because they're either attributed to the person's infection or they occur after, maybe weeks after the person takes the antibiotic. And so a lot of these deaths are chalked off to something else. So I'm only counting the official deaths, the deaths from antibiotic-resistant MRSA and the deaths from the antibiotic resistant pseudomembranous enterocolitis. So just those two causes of death alone is 63,000. I'm not counting the deaths from the antibiotics where the antibiotics lead the person to commit suicide, for example. If you look at the increase in suicide rate in the United States, it correlates very tightly with increased antidepressant use and increased antibiotic use. So it's very important to avoid antibiotics. And this report, even though it's free, can save your life.
Right. Sure. And antibiotics totally destroy your immune system. And I think it's important, too, that that people understand that there are antibiotics, not just in the bottle that they get from the drugstore, but in the meat that they might be consuming, in the milk. Go ahead and tell us about that.
80% of all antibiotics in the United States are not prescribed by your doctor or a hospital. They are put into your meat supply without your knowledge. And so even though you may never have gone to see a doctor, your dose of antibiotics you've been eating is very high and high enough to give you a antibiotic-resistant infection and possibly even kill you. So it's important to avoid antibiotics every place. In other words, not to eat meat that has antibiotics in it, not to drink milk that has antibiotics in it, and they are now even putting antibiotics in the chicken feed for egg-laying hens. So if you're eating regular eggs from a chicken that's got commercial feed, you're eating antibiotic-laced chicken eggs. And this is really a serious matter. The other thing to realize is there seems to be a tipping point. So a certain once you reach a certain level of antibiotic intake, boom, that's when you become or get deadly resistant bacteria in your body. So everything you do, whether it's eating a piece of antibiotic-infected meat, whether it's taking a prescription for antibiotics from the doctor, all of these things bring you closer to that point where, boom, it tips you over into having antibiotic-resistant organisms. The other problem with antibiotics is now they've been linked to cancer. So you take the antibiotics do the damage, they do the harm, get the yeast infection, then you go on to get cancer.
Yikes. Well, I'm very lucky. I have an Amish farmer that delivers to this area. I get my eggs, raw milk, beef that's antibiotic-free, grass-fed. I don't know what I would eat if I didn't have this Amish farmer.
I think people are talking about changing legislation, maybe to regulate the FDA, make it do this, make it do that. That is not the legislation you need. There's two pieces of legislation that I see would solve this problem very quickly in terms of the toxicity of drugs. One is just to let the FDA do what the FDA is going to do, but do not use any U.S. military or police power to enforce any patent. People can get all the patents they want, but it's just paper. The government will not deploy police resources to enforce a patent. And if you just do that one thing, you're going to wipe out the total profit, which is all it's about is the money. And so if the government simply refuses to deploy police and military action on behalf of protecting patents, then this whole problem will just go away. That's one thing. Good luck with that. The next thing, which might be a little more realistic or tenable, is yourself to not take antibiotics and to have the ordinances in your neighborhood change so anybody who wants to can grow chickens in their backyard.
Oh, I would love to have chickens in my backyard.
Unfortunately, they do come with a rooster, so there's, you know, either you're going to have a rooster waking you up from time to time, or you're going to have antibiotics silently killing you. So that's your choice.
Yes, yes, indeed. A question from the chat room. Do antibiotics hinder the natural cortisol production?
I'm not familiar with that, and I would imagine it would depend on the particular antibiotic. I would imagine that actually antibiotics would stimulate cortisol production, that the antibiotics, if you put them in your body, they are antibiotics, they're anti-life. So the antibiotics actually kill you directly. And the adrenal gland often will produce cortisol to try and, respond to the stress.
Another question. Isn't penicillin a natural antibiotic?
So penicillin is actually the side product of a fungus. Say it's a natural antibiotic made from the mold or fungus of orange peels. But kind of begs the question, when you have an infection, I mean, who needs a fungus?
Right.
But penicillin also has many devastating health effects. Again, People need to understand these are really are antibiotics. They really are anti-life, and they actually kill you. So the antibiotics actually disable and kill your own body's cells. This discussion about good bacteria, bad bacteria, I think totally misses the point. I don't agree with that at all. I don't even use probiotics, so there you have it.
Right.
And I've been able to heal people from fungal infections, bacterial infections, all kinds of stuff without using probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
So the real deal is you have damaged tissue. You need the fungus to eat up that damaged tissue so your body's healing mechanisms can then come in and heal and build new tissue for you. So the fungus is not some external thing. The fungus is actually right there in your body here and now, part of your immune system helping you. And so if you start disabling your immune system, well, that doesn't make any sense. What makes more sense is to, you know, rinse out the bacteria, allow the bacteria away to leave, and basically give yourself a mild case of diarrhea or have more bowel movements. So you can do an enema, you can take some castor oil, you can take Dr. Daniel's Vitality Capsules, which will be on sale in a couple of days, or whatever you need to do, and drink a lot of clean water. Clean water is filtered water. That would be if you have an infection, either distilled or reverse osmosis. If you don't have an infection, then you can just have, you know, heavily filtered water filtered through a ceramic filter and a carbon filter.
Mm-hmm. All righty. Now, you do believe in eating fermented foods, sauerkraut, and that kind of thing. True?
Yep, I believe in that, yep.
All righty. We are going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back, and we will take phone calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back. Deanna, our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. Her website is vitalitycapsules.com, and we do have a caller. Let's take Lynn in Washington. Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna, and thank you, Dr. Daniels. My question, and I wasn't able to listen to all of the show, so I'm not sure if you covered this or not, but what about what to do for hypothyroidism?
Very interesting. First of all, hypothyroidism is very troubling. It's troubling because people who have hypothyroid symptoms, you know, fatigue, gaining weight, hair falling out, increased level of confusion and forgetfulness, all these things, classic underactive thyroid symptoms, and they can go to the doctor and all their thyroid tests are normal. And that's one problem. The other problem is you have a person, if all these thyroid symptoms, they go to the doctor, their thyroid tests are out of whack, the doctor gives them some thyroid medicine, all their tests are nice and normal, and they still feel lousy.
That's me.
Yeah. This is just absolutely devastating. I would say, you know, you might even want to call it criminal. The real problem is that what doctors are measuring has nothing to do with your thyroid's activity. And you've got to come to that conclusion once your doctor's normalized all of your test results and you still feel lousy, that what's really wrong is not your thyroid but something else. So what I would say for a thyroid condition is definitely do not take a patented pharmaceutical chemical product. That would be the Synthroids, the levothyroxins, and those things. Oh, I have to say, this is not medical advice. Maybe I went to medical school, but I'm not licensed. Any action you take is your responsibility, and I have no liability for it. So having said that, you want to go for the desiccated thyroid, and you want to get the cleanest, purest form of that that you can. So my experience on people who have, let's say you start out with bad results, or abnormal lab test, if you take the pure desiccated thyroid, then everything clears up and you become a normal person again.
Desiccated. Can you spell that?
D-E-S-S-I-C-A-T-E-D. Desiccated.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, let's say you have those other listeners out there. Let's say you have all these hypo, underactive thyroid symptoms, and the doctor keeps testing, and all the tests are normal. But you still feel lousy. You've read these books, you've done this research, you've looked on the internet, and you know all of your symptoms are hypoactive thyroid symptoms. Probably you're the victim of poisoning. In which case, it makes sense to try and figure out what the poison is and address that particular poisoning.
I thank you for your time and your answer. Have a good day, ladies. I appreciate it.
All righty. Thank you, Lynn.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, let's take David in Florida. David, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have just been to the doctor and the emergency room. I'm on Ormer thyroid and half grain, and my level, cortisol levels are 5.1. They should be 15 to 20, and I'm wondering what to do. They wanted me, I'm allergic to the medicine, the cortisol, and they gave me an overdose prescription of it. And it was supposed to be 2 tabs a day, and they wrote 2.5 tabs a day, and that would be 75 milligrams a day, and so it should have been, 50? And so 5 days I spent trying not to go to the ER, and I finally went yesterday, and they wanted me to stay on the drug, and and the funny thing is, this guy has no ego. I was so ecstatic to meet this new doctor, endocrinologist.
Yeah.
And he just seems so wonderful.
Nice guy.
And it turns out they're taking cortisone off the market next month.
Really?
And they knew that and still prescribed it. And I'm wondering what I do for low cortisol, because I'm running out of gas here really bad.
All right, so the question is, there's a lot of questions you've asked here, but we could just answer the obvious.
Yeah.
If you believe you've got a cortisol deficiency and you want to go down this medical route, then I would say you don't really need to worry.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tie your cortisone cream on the market, you spread it on your skin, it absorbs the same as if you ate it. So there is no shortage of cortisol out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one way or another, you're going to get cortisol. And they've got all kinds of different preparations of cortisol. I think what they're taking off the market is the stuff that's gone generic, that they can't make too much
money. It is a generic. I know that much.
Yeah. So they're going to all the high-priced stuff you'll have access to, so don't worry about that.
So I should take one of the brand names?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm answering your question.
Oh, yeah.
The question is, how are you going to get cortisol?
Okay.
With my body, I'd walk away from it.
Yeah,
So your question is, how do you get cortisol? That's your answer. The answer is, pay more money and take the other stuff that's approved. Okay, the other question is, a more pertinent question, I think, is how do you solve your problem, which is you're running out of gas?
Right.
Exactly. That's a different question. So for that, I would say you need to get to the real issue, and it sounds to me like you've got something affecting your adrenal glands, and that's what needs to be addressed. You can send an email to support@vitalitycapsules.com, and Gabriel will get back to you with a little form to fill out or whatever. We'll figure out if there's something I could help you with. If I can't help you, I'll tell you what I think you should do instead.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
All righty. Thank you. All righty. Let's take Joshua in California. Joshua?
Yes. Hello, Deanna. Hello, Dr. Daniels. Yes, I just wanted the doctor's comments in regards to kids, HIV and AIDS patients, and then the treatment with human growth hormone. And then they also give to the AIDS patients, almost like they're trying to keep them alive while they take their pill cocktails. And also why they keep that treatment so high in the weight from the consenting adult, and if you actually go to the doctors and ask the doctor for a prescription for human growth hormone, they look at you like you're crazy. And I'll take that off the air. Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're talking about HIV/AIDS, are we?
And the treatment of human growth hormone, in which they give to children and also adults with HIV or AIDS, and a consenting adult can't get it. Just your thoughts on human growth hormone altogether.
Oh, okay, human growth hormone. My thoughts on human growth hormone, you know, I'm only a family practice doctor. I've only had 5,000 patients in my medical practice, you know, when I was practicing as a doctor. And I've never once seen a case where human growth hormone could help anybody. So that's that. I mean, that's just my personal experience on it. And even the cases I'm aware of where human growth hormone has been proposed as medically helpful, again, I've not seen that. I've not seen the benefits of it. So I would tell anyone, if your doctor tells you you need human growth hormone, I would definitely urge you to look into, you know, alternative types of avenues and to focus on exactly what your problem is. So if your problem is feeling lousy, then there's another way to handle it.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All right.
And the HIV/AIDS test, they definitely need to listen to my audio, which is AIDS, a truth too huge to hide.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, there's so many things out there, so many diseases that they've actually created. Isn't that true? In order to have a medicate
them? Well, you say they created a disease. That says the disease exists. What they've done is they have, through propaganda, created an imagination in your mind that the disease exists. Created the perception of the imagination of the disease. Some examples are prostate cancer. You're actually going to live 4 years longer with prostate cancer than without it. Another imaginary disease is cholesterol. You actually live longer with higher cholesterol. And if you lower your cholesterol beyond a certain point, you actually increase your death rate. And then, of course, there's HIV, AIDS, another imaginary disease. In other words, a disease exists only in the mind of the person who believes they have it. It's impossible to die of AIDS if you haven't been diagnosed.
That is amazing. All righty. Well, it's certainly been a pleasure to have you on the program. I hope that people will tune into your program this Sunday evening. And that's on RBN from 7 to 9, and that's Central Time. And that's Healing with Dr. Jennifer Daniels. So thank you so much for being on the program today.
You're absolutely welcome. People should get their free antibiotic report at drjenniferdaniels.com.
Great. All righty. Thank you so much.
Okay,
bye-bye.
You're welcome.